It's very complicated to write.
In addition to the terror things like
Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, August 4, 2014.
This goes far beyond waterboarding and
in a separate program operated by the Central Intelligence Agency.
We open with the opening strains of a song called Waterboarding by the rappers Mobb Deep.
The overriding instinct of everything is
President Obama talked about torture and admitted we tortured some folks.
Waterboard hip hop, I torture the flow like water. The drought over, yeah, here we go. Used to spit, now I pour my soul into the shit. Praise God, Mobb Deep goes hard, it never ends. You can drown in this ocean of dopeness. Jump into this deep, dark abyss. I'm swimming, they wish, they pray, they hope.
The deep, deep, dark abyss of America's recent past. The president talked about it on Friday in a way that was remarkably inept. I found it insulting. And because of the phraseology he used in an impromptu, you know, unscripted comment at a press conference, the president inarticulately said, yeah, we tortured some folks. And you're about to hear the entire clip because I'm going to talk back to the president of the United States in the same breath where he acknowledged that America made serious errors after 9/11. He criticized people like me and warned that we shouldn't be too sanctimonious. You're about to hear that remark as well. This is all a kind of preemptive spin, because as of Friday, the White House believed that the Senate's torture report, I'm sorry, it's called a review, not a report. And it wasn't an investigation, it was a review. But it appeared as if the report would be released pretty soon. But late on Friday, as the entire Congress left Washington for a 5-week break that they don't deserve, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, chair of the Intelligence Committee, she said, well, the CIA imposed so many redactions when the president let them review the review before publication that I'm going to hold on to this and review the review one more time and see if these blackouts are justifiable. So I'd like you to listen now to the comments of the president at the press conference on Friday. And as I said, I really think that his remarks were inept. They should have been scripted if he was going to talk about something this important. In terms of his articulation, Barack Obama is able to say nuclear. George W. Bush always botched it as nuclear. But they both have this weakness of referring to unnamed people as folks. And so you're going to hear Obama admit that we tortured some folks, and then he's going to talk about the folks who tortured those folks. And the folks who did the torture, he said, were great Americans, were patriots. And that's what I find so insulting. Let's listen.
Even before I came into office, I was very clear that in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did some things that were contrary to our values. I understand why it happened.
This is where the rationalization kicks in. He says that because it was so scary after 9/11, the hardened professionals in our military, in our intelligence complex, were so freaked out that they resorted to torture to try to prevent the next attack. This hysteria crossed the line into war crimes, which are now rationalized by this president as a human and understandable reaction to those events.
I think it's important when we look back to recall how afraid people were after Twin Towers fell and the Pentagon had been
hit. Yeah, play the 9/11 card, just like Rudy Giuliani.
People did not know whether more attacks were imminent, and there was enormous pressure on our law enforcement and our national security teams to try to deal with this. It's important for us not to feel too sanctimonious in retrospect.
Now, this is where I take deep, deep offense. Because holding people accountable to the values that the president just referred to is not sanctimonious. And this is where I have a real fundamental problem with this president and with what he has presided over since 2009. Because he has refused to investigate, to prosecute the clear wrongdoing that occurred and which he just admitted to before he started to spin it up and rationalize it. And so this term sanctimonious goes into the phrase book that includes the professional left, derided by Obama and Rahm Emanuel when he was chief of staff in the White House. And for the president at this point to try to soften the impact of this forthcoming Senate report and to explain away his own participation in what is a clear pattern of obstruction of justice is inexcusable. It's unforgivable. And this is why when the term impeachment, which is being played in Washington right now in a bizarre way, when it's used, and I hear Republicans call for impeachment over relatively trivial matters, this is the most crucial matter that I believe this president is vulnerable to impeachment for. And, of course, he knows that bloodthirsty Republicans who cheered Bush and the torture regime, people like Mitt Romney who said, "I want a double Gitmo," he knows that those Republicans won't come after him. And sadly, members of his own party, for different reasons, refuse to uphold the law when it is being violated and bulldozed by one of their own.
About the tough job that those folks had. And a lot of those folks were working hard under enormous pressure and are real patriots. But having said all that, we did some things that were wrong.
So, how do you reconcile praising the people who did something that's wrong? In the same press conference, this president said that he has full confidence in John Brennan, now running the CIA, where he worked for the past 30 years, with a little break for a tour of the Obama White House in the first term where he was the drone meister. John Brennan has his full confidence. And James Clapper, the proven perjurer who is at the top of our spook tree, he said, well, the redactions in the Senate report are minor. He said 85% of it's in the footnotes. Maybe that's true, but Brennan has been permitted to apologize to Feinstein for the misleading, if not outright dishonest, comments that he made back in March when it was exposed that the CIA had inappropriately looked at the computers of the Senate staffers. And then Brennan tried to cover that up. And Obama, in offering his full-throated support for Brennan, said, you know, keep in mind that it was John. John Brennan was the person who called for the Inspector General report, and he's already stood up a task force to make sure that lessons are learned and mistakes are resolved. That is so offensive. George Tenet, whose fingerprints were all over the torture program from his term as CIA director, was permitted to lead the little team that decided what could not be released to the public in this report on torture, rendition, and detention. And we have some senators who are calling on Brennan to resign, but not enough of them. I think only two so far. Others are calling on the Justice Department to reopen the investigation into the CIA spying on the Senate. And we learned that the Justice Department knew of the findings of the CIA Inspector General when the Justice Department shut down its investigation and possible prosecution of wrongdoing in this case. This really stinks. And our oh-too-polite news media in this country and the political class that wants to fight over children at the border instead of the long-term impact of these serious constitutional violations. I just feel like we're in a very, very bizarre time, friends. And let me just note that while I take Barack Obama at his word that America doesn't torture anymore, at least not using the overt so-called harsh interrogation techniques, I don't have proof of that, but I'm willing to take the president's word for that. But his actions in terms of detention speak so loudly and unfortunately differ very little from his predecessor. Take the case of Yunus Rahmatulla. He was just released in May after a 10-year odyssey under American torture and detention. And he appears to be a completely innocent man who was picked up in 2004, mistaken for a terrorist by a special forces team of British soldiers in Iraq. And he reports being repeatedly tortured. And then they sent him to the Parwan prison, which is part of the Bagram Air Base complex near Kabul, Afghanistan. You want to hear what they did to him? Well, the British forces tied him to a moving vehicle, stripped him naked and doused him with cold water, placed him in a tiny room where he couldn't stand or recline, poured water onto a cheesecloth in a style reminiscent, the article says, of waterboarding. Later, when U.S. forces in Iraq took custody of the man, he had his hands secured to a post above his head, was stripped naked, suspended above a tank of cold water, and led around on a makeshift leash by a woman guard. Then he was threatened with transfer to Guantanamo if he wouldn't talk. But instead, for unclear reasons, they sent him to Bagram, where he was locked away for 10 years, and this president didn't lock him up, but he didn't release him until this past May. And there is this whole blackout on who the prisoners are at Parwan, on the fact that they're not permitted to see attorneys, they're not permitted access to American courts. It is a dark black hole. And at the time, he was kept incommunicado from his family for 6 years, and then calls were permitted, but he wasn't allowed to tell them the truth about why he was being held and how he was being denied basic human rights. That's just one story that Obama bears responsibility for. The other comes from a Sunday editorial in the New York Times regarding a young man that we've covered on this program extensively in the past. His name is Omar Khadr. He's now 27 years old, a Canadian citizen. He was captured in Afghanistan at the age of 15. He was there with his father, a jihadist. And we've covered in detail in the past. If you go to peterbcollins.com and just enter Khadr, K-H-A-D-R, in the search box there, you'll find interviews I've done with activist Lisa Hajar, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and other conversations I've had about Omar Khadr and the incident that he was accused of throwing a hand grenade at an American soldier, and that somehow that was a worse violation than you know, simply shooting a soldier or anything else that happens in combat. It was one of the most unusual cases we've ever seen. And there is substantial information to show that Omar Khadr is innocent of the charges that he pled guilty to as the only way to get out of Guantanamo. So there was a deal made after he pled guilty to those charges. He has now recanted those admissions of guilt. But he was shipped back to Canada, where he was supposed to have been released by now, but he is still locked up. And the Toronto Star has filed requests to interview him so they can get his side of the story. But just like Obama has done with torture victims led by Binyam Mohamed, whose case came before an appeals court just after Obama became president. And the Obama legal team invoked the state secrets privilege and said that even though most of the information is public, we're calling it secret, you cannot try this case. And in Canada, the top courts are blocking media access to Omar Khadr. And I have no proof, but my clear suspicion is that that is being done at the behest of the United States government. Again, these are appalling, appalling situations. President Obama is two-faced. He can acknowledge that some folks were tortured, but none of the folks who tortured those folks will pay any price for it. And our nation has lost a lot of goodwill and respect that we had in the world. Because we can play the denial games and, you know, spin it up in our media. We can keep our government from holding anybody accountable. But the rest of the world is not fooled. And I'm going to link to Andy Worthington's latest report in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. I hope you'll read it. We reported on this when it occurred a week or two ago, but a European Union Human Rights Court made a finding that Abu Zubaydah and one other man still held at Guantanamo were tortured at a black site in Poland, and they ordered Poland to pay money damages to these men still held by the United States. This is another deep embarrassment that Obama presides over. Sure, he said he wanted to close Guantanamo, but he is inching toward that goal in an excruciatingly slow process. And he's acknowledged that somewhere more than 50 of the men being held there will never be charged or tried, including Abu Zubaydah. And I cannot, in some ways, find adequate words to describe just how angry this makes me. We'll update the war on Gaza next. I want to pause to thank the people who make this program possible with your subscriptions. Alan Van Tress, Dan Shannon, Daryl Rotramel, Sharon Gadberry. They're all monthly subscribers here at peterbcollins.com. And that's what keeps it all going here, so I hope you'll join them. Come on over. You know the drill. Look under my picture on the website homepage. There's a link that says sign up. Next page, you choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Dist's rock and roll CD called Red Flag as a bonus gift for signing up for a new annual subscription. Well, today was supposed to be a point where Israel's unilateral ceasefire from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Gaza time was a signal that Israel is mopping up its bloody operations in Gaza after 3.5 weeks. But it's disputed exactly when this happened, whether it was minutes before the ceasefire was supposed to take effect or minutes after. But the Israeli Defense Forces, as they're called, struck a house in the Shati refugee camp in Gaza, killing a girl aged 8 and wounding at least 29 others. And this follows the events of yesterday that have been widely condemned, where the United Nations said that one of its schools was hit on Sunday, killing 7 people in addition to intended targets who were described as Islamic Jihad fighters on a motorcycle. And this drew commentary from the United States, which is pretty hypocritical about all this stuff, as I've pointed out. But the U.S. State Department condemned in harsh terms what it calls today's disgraceful shelling outside the school in Rafah. They said that those who were killed or hurt were waiting in line for food supplies when the missile hit. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who's becoming a little more assertive, he called the attack a moral outrage and a criminal act, a gross violation of international humanitarian law. The death toll now 1,822 on the Palestinian side, 71 killed on Sunday alone, almost 10,000 injured. And Israel's death count is 64 soldiers and 3 civilians. Now, Israel keeps playing games with ceasefires because Israel has said it's not participating in the current ceasefire talks that have started up again in Cairo. But it announced a temporary humanitarian window and then, with fingers crossed, said it did not apply to areas where soldiers are currently operating, like Rafah. Well, how are the people in Gaza supposed to know when an Israeli ceasefire is real and when it's partial or qualified or subject to change? And this is as we look back, and I'm concerned that with the rush of events, that actions that occurred as recently as 3 or 4 days ago get lost in the fog of war, the fog of wartime propaganda. And so, as you may recall, Friday there was supposed to be a 72-hour ceasefire, and Israel said that Hamas broke the ceasefire. But again, the issues are in dispute, because during the hours just before the ceasefire was scheduled to take effect, Israel moved troops closer to Rafah for the first time in 22 days. And as part of their qualified ceasefire, Israel said, well, we're going to have a ceasefire, but we reserve the right to blow up more tunnels. So these redeployed troops near Rafah found or exposed a tunnel, started to blow it up, and Hamas fighters surfaced, one a suicide bomber, and they fought back. And initially, immediately, Netanyahu blames Hamas. Obama echoed, parroted that at his news conference in Washington later in the day. But it's not that clear. And I have found Benjamin Netanyahu to be a serial liar, one who will say things that are, you know, obviously false and say them with such thunderous, aggressive assertiveness that we're all supposed to just say, oh, whatever you say, Bibi. And so following this event, and again, the U.S. took the Israeli line, but I'm not at all convinced that it's true. Nonetheless, Netanyahu lectured the Obama administration, saying not to ever second-guess me again when he points the finger at Hamas. Well, he lied for 18 days over the corpses of the 3 Israeli teenagers who were kidnapped. And to assume that he's telling the truth now and that the United States cannot ever second-guess him again, went on to say that he should be trusted on the issue and about the unwillingness of Hamas to follow through on ceasefire talks. And then they used the term kidnapped to refer to an Israeli soldier who they thought had been captured by Hamas in the Rafah event near the tunnel that I just described for you. Now, in hostilities like this, you capture an enemy combatant. That is not a kidnap. I think it's fair to say that during the 18 days when Israel knew those 3 teens were dead and they rounded up hundreds of members of Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank, accusing them of some connection to the kidnapped teenagers, those Hamas members, most of whom had been released in the prisoner swap a few months ago, they were kidnapped. They're being held. They're being detained. And so the use of the language, the spin, the propaganda is just so amazing. And here in the United States, so many ill-informed people who are either just blindly pro-Israel or who, you know, assume that because the media says Hamas is always evil, that you don't have to even think deeply about it. Hamas bad, Israel must be good. Well, here is here's an amazing revelation. As the United States gets a taste of its own medicine, Der Spiegel, the respected German publication, has learned from reliable sources that Israeli intelligence eavesdropped on Secretary of State John Kerry during the recent Middle East peace negotiations. In addition to the Israelis, at least one other intelligence service also listened in as Kerry mediated last year between Israel, the Palestinians, and Arab states. This according to several intelligence sources contacted by Der Spiegel. Revelations of the eavesdropping could further damage already tense relations between the U.S. government and Israel. And apparently, during the talks last year, Kerry spoke regularly with negotiating partners, and some of these calls were not made on encrypted equipment, but instead on normal telephones with the conversations transmitted by satellite. Now, just hold this in your mind for a moment, okay? Because we have Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, both burned by American NSA spies listening in on their personal cell phones. So this is payback, right? Pure and simple. Well, Glenn Greenwald goes deep today, and I'll link to his latest article at The Intercept, based on documents supplied by Ed Snowden. My summation is, the U.S. is being rolled by Israel. Because what Greenwald recounts is the long-term relationship between the U.S. and Israel and our respective spy agencies. And the U.S. provides not only signals intelligence, raw intelligence information, but also cash payments to Israel, according to this latest dispatch from Greenwald. And Greenwald adds his own commentary to it, saying that the covert supply and covert support, that the U.S. provides is squarely at odds with the posture of helpless detachment typically adopted by Obama officials and their supporters. The new Snowden documents illustrate that Israeli aggression would be impossible without the constant lavish support and protection of the U.S. government. And that not only includes the resupply of munitions that we authorized almost in the same breath as the condemnation of these attacks on innocent civilians in Gaza, but a document from April 2013 published by The Intercept says that the signals intelligence relationship has increasingly been the catalyst for a broader intelligence relationship between the U.S. and Israel. It's supplied Israel with ample support for both intelligence and surveillance. And the details here are stunning, but Greenwald publishes two different receipts for $500,000 in cash, and part of it's redacted, some of it's misspelled, but one is dated the 15th of April, 2004, Oh, they're both dated that, and each is for $500,000. It's not really clear what that money was paid for, but it appears to be part of our ongoing intelligence sharing. And not only that, but regional partners like Jordan, the nation of Jordan, feed surveillance data about the Palestinians to the NSA. And so we are a partner with Israel in its brutal attacks on Gaza. And yet, we cannot control our partner. Obama has been begging Netanyahu to stop these attacks, particularly the gruesome attacks on innocent civilians. And he says, you got to trust me and don't ever second guess me again. You may recall that in Cuba, it was revealed that the United States, through the U.S. Agency for International Development, which is really just a front for the CIA, had some people there promoting democracy. And there's this guy, Alan Gross, who has been locked up by the Cubans as he brought some sensitive technology into the country, and they tried to spin it up as if, you know, he was just trying to help people out. Well, we set up a phony kind of Twitter copy in Cuba, and that was exposed earlier this year. And now the Associated Press is reporting that as early as October 2009, USAID recruited Venezuelan, Costa Rican, and Peruvian young people to go to Cuba. We paid them $5.41 an hour. And we told them to infiltrate and, you know, find some Cubans who want to overthrow the government. In one case, the workers formed an HIV prevention workshop that memos called the perfect excuse for the program's political goals. But these young people were given a 30-minute seminar on how to evade Cuban intelligence and otherwise just left on their own. And this is an amateurish, comical, exposed operation of the U.S. intelligence community. And finally today, I don't typically shed a tear for members of the administration of Ronald Reagan who pass away. It's that time of their lives. Those guys and a few gals are getting old. But today I honor his former press secretary, James Brady. Jim Brady was badly injured in the attempt to assassinate Ronald Reagan that took place at what we call the Hinckley Hilton in Washington, D.C., the Capitol Hilton. Actually, the Capitol Hilton is closer to the White House. It's the Hilton up on up past Georgetown, which is where the events occurred there. At any rate, Brady was an interesting guy, and before he was injured, he was a pretty funny press secretary, and of course he represented some of the evil policies of the Reagan team. But after he was injured, despite the handicaps that it left him with for life, Jim Brady became an outspoken advocate for gun control. We have the Brady Bill, named after him. And he really stood as a man who could get beyond the partisan politics that he had fronted for as a paid flack and say, no, you know, I barely survived an episode because a crazy guy was able to get a gun. And when we look at the way the NRA has turned that debate and won it, well, Jim Brady, he truly gave his life to try to improve the lives of other Americans. And I honor him as we note his passing today. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. You're invited to share this with absolutely everyone.
Happy trails.